The 8 o'clock buzz with Brian Standing. WORT Madison.
Hello, I'm Emily Thomas with the BBC News. A new report backed by the United Nations says famine is expected between now and May in the north of the Gaza Strip. The report by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification says about half of Gaza's population is already facing catastrophic hunger. Stephanie Hegarty reports.
The conditions for declaring a famine are strict. 20% of the population must be starving, 30% of children must be severely malnourished or wasted, and the death rate from malnutrition must double. The first two have already been exceeded in northern Gaza, and with the rate of mortality of children rising sharply, famine is now expected there any day. Half the population of Gaza are in the catastrophic phase of food insecurity, which means they're starving. And in the north, one in three children is acutely malnourished. Israel says it has increased aid into Gaza via its border on the north of the Strip, but aid agencies say the quantities coming in will have to ramp up rapidly for the worst disaster to be averted.
Pakistan has confirmed it carried out what it called anti-terrorist operations in the border regions inside Afghanistan. Earlier, Afghanistan's Taliban rulers said 8 people were killed in the strikes. Caroline Davis is in Islamabad.
We've just had confirmation from the Foreign Ministry here in Pakistan confirming that Pakistan did carry out attacks inside Afghanistan territory. The statement has come saying that this morning Pakistan carried out intelligence-based anti-terrorist operations in the border regions inside Afghanistan. They say that the target of the operations was a particular terrorist group that is responsible, they say, for multiple terrorist attacks, including one that happened on Saturday. We know that took the lives of 7 members of the military here in Pakistan.
Ethiopia's largest commercial bank is trying to retrieve millions of dollars withdrawn by its customers after an incident it described as a systems glitch. More than $40 million were reportedly withdrawn from the state-owned Commercial Bank of Ethiopia or transferred to other banks when customers found out they could take out more cash than they had in their accounts. A cyber attack has been ruled out as the cause. The European Union has denounced Russia's presidential election, which, according to official results, saw Vladimir Putin re-elected by a landslide. The result has been welcomed by Russia's allies. Here's Danny Eberhard.
In a statement on behalf of the EU, its foreign affairs chief, Josep Borrell, said Russia's election had taken place in an environment characterised by accelerating and systematic repression. Russian voters, Mr. Borrell said, had been deprived of a real choice. He also described the vote in illegally occupied parts of Ukraine as null and void. China, unsurprisingly, has been far more positive. President Xi and Mr. Putin spoke of further strengthening their country's ties.
BBC News.
Hola y bienvenido. Are you interested in learning about poets who write in the Spanish language, then are translated into English and published in bilingual editions? On Monday, March 18th, at 7 o'clock p.m., the WORT Access Hour will be presenting a special program, Shared Visions, Bilingual Poetry in English and Spanish, discussing the ongoing process of translations, its similarities and differences, its joys and pitfalls. Host James P. Roberts and guest Diego Alegría will share examples of their favorite poets and how reading them has affected their own poetry. That's Shared Visions, Bilingual Poetry in English and Spanish on Monday, March 18th at 7 o'clock p.m. on the Access Hour.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles, services for new and used bicycles, is available on the web at budgetbicyclectr.com.
Thank you. Good morning. It's 8:06, and you're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. This is Brian Standing. On April 2nd, Wisconsin voters will cast ballots for local and county offices for the U.S. presidential primary and for two amendments to the state constitution. The League of Women Voters wants you to vote down those changes to the state charter. Sue Jenick, program director for the Dane County League of Women Voters, will tell us why. And also on the voting front, in-person absentee voting starts tomorrow for the city of Madison. Madison City Clerk Maribeth Witzel tells us what's new this year and how the city is preparing. And former University of Wisconsin professor Matthew Backham reflects on his career as an archivist, artist, and investigator. WORT's Jose Carlos Teixeira interviews Backham as part of WORT's Framing Culture series. We'll have all that, plus some announcements, the Outdoor Adventure Report, a look at the weather, and some tasty tunes served up by our co-engineers today, Nicholas Wooten and Nate Carlin. All that's coming up right after this. It's 8:10. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. The Wisconsin legislature continues its efforts to sidestep Democratic Governor Tony Evers' veto pen with a couple of state constitutional amendments on this April's ballot. Constitutional amendments must pass two successive legislative sessions and then be approved in a statewide referendum, but are not subject to gubernatorial approval. The Wisconsin and Dane County League of Women Voters urge a no vote on both amendments up this year. Sue Jenick, program director of the Dane County League of Women Voters and chair of the Wisconsin League of Women Voters Legislative Committee, joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Good morning, Brian.
Well, thanks so much for joining us this morning. So tell us, first off, both of these constitutional amendments have to do with ballots and election and the process by which those are counted. Is this still part of the alleged mis elections that happened in 2020?
Well, I think that's one of the motivations for these amendments. I mean, there's still some people who have suspicions about whether our elections are conducted properly, and these amendments are addressing that concern of theirs.
And there have been a number of independent reviews of Wisconsin elections that have shown that they're quite fair. They're one of the better run in the country, aren't they?
They absolutely are, and there really hasn't been any proof at all that there have been problems with election administration.
Well, let's talk specifically about what each of these constitutional amendments would do. Let's start with the question one, which is talking about using private funds in election administration. And basically, this would prohibit any private donations or grants for any election. What is this aimed at?
Well, what it comes out of is the 2020 election, when a foundation funded by Mark Zuckerberg and his wife donated money to municipalities throughout the country, including Wisconsin, to assist them in running the election during the pandemic. As we saw in Milwaukee during the primary, there were only 5 polling places open for the entire city, and there were long lines and, you know, difficulties in conducting that election. After that primary, the Zuckerbergs donated this money, made this money available, and any municipality in the state that applied for the money got the money. There were over 221 municipalities in Wisconsin that got those funds. So there's no question that it was, you know, not targeted to any particular area, as some have suggested.
And there wasn't anything partisan. There were no requirements, or it wasn't doled out in a way that was inherently partisan from this foundation, was it?
No, it was not. In fact, once the money goes to a government agency that's running the election, it becomes government funds. And those funds, the use of those funds, are determined by that government agency, not anyone else.
So why should people vote no on this particular initiative?
Well, the biggest reason is we don't have guaranteed funding of our elections. There's money that comes from the state that doesn't cover everything. There may be federal funds, but that varies from year to year. And then the municipalities have to make up the difference. And so, you know, when there are times when they don't have sufficient funds to adequately run an election, they need to go to outsiders. And that has happened many times in the past and hopefully will continue. Another reason is private donations is a very broad term and could present difficulties for municipalities that, for example, conduct their election in a church room donated by the church. And would that be a private donation that would not be permitted? Under the strict wording of this language, it would.
So would the League of Women Voters support an effort to provide sufficient public funds for all municipalities to conduct elections efficiently and well? And if so, would there then no longer be a need for these kinds of private donations or grants?
Well, if there were sufficient public funds guaranteed, yes, that would be preferable, of course. But I don't know if that would ever be the case, that it was guaranteed. And therefore, you know, the legislature may decide that there should be some regulations about the use of private money for administering elections. That would be fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think, you know, there could be a compromise negotiated with the governor to put in place some guardrails. But that's not what this amendment does. This amendment is a flat prohibition on the use of any outside money.
Now let's move on to question two on the ballot. And this one says, shall the Constitution be created to provide that only election officials designated by law may perform tasks in the conduct of primaries, elections, and referendums? Now this sounds fairly innocuous, but what's going on here?
Well, for one thing, it's totally unnecessary. There's already a statute that says that. And so why this needs to be in the Constitution is a mystery to me. Again, the language is vaguely worded and could present difficulties for those running elections. For example, they may rely on the manufacturer of election machines in order to help them if there's a problem with that. Is that a task conducted in the performance of the election? You know, that that kind of language could impose restrictions on the clerks, the many clerks around the state who are doing their best to run fair elections.
Now, in every election, we, you know, all have friends and family who work as poll workers. Many of us have done that in the past. Is that one of the entities that is considered designated by law that can perform tasks in the conduct of those elections? Or would that create problems with people volunteering their time as poll workers?
No, volunteers would definitely, I think, under any reading of this law, volunteers would continue to be able to be poll workers. They are trained, they are certified by the clerk where they're working. And so there, I don't think there's an issue with the poll workers. But there could be an issue, you know, with others who are assisting in conducting the election. Would this reach even somebody who brings food into poll workers or donates food into poll workers? You know, would those issues arise under these two amendments?
And is there, have proponents of this amendment identified particular issues that they see as problems that they're trying to address? Or is this a solution in search of a problem?
Well, I have not seen any explanation of why the Second Amendment is being proposed. And I've looked for it. And other people I know have looked for it. And all they say is, only election officials should run elections. And yeah, that's true. And that's what our statute says. And if rules are being violated, then we already have a mechanism to take care of that.
And what about
our Constitution?
Go ahead.
Our Constitution should provide basic rights and responsibilities. And putting in these details into our Constitution is just not appropriate.
And what about voter registration drives? Is that, how do those work under current law, and would this initiative change that?
I don't think either of these initiatives would affect our voter registration drives. I mean, it is related to the election, but it's not the conduct of the election. So I don't think that would be affected at all. And all the many groups, including the League, that do voter registration can continue to do that.
So what is the League of Women Voters doing to advance your point of view on these particular ballot initiatives?
Well, we're appearing on your show, for one thing, and thank you for the opportunity to do that. We're doing letters to the editor, our members are, our president is, our state league has also appeared on TV and radio programs. We're getting the word out to all of our members. We have a slideshow presentation that we can present to groups if they ask for it, to give details about these amendments. We have flyers, we have a toolkit. we're doing a full-scale campaign throughout the state.
And how has reception been so far?
Well, the groups that I have talked to initially looked at this language and say, I don't know, it sounds reasonable. What's wrong with it? But once we have a conversation about it, the reception I have experienced is that people say, yeah, this doesn't make sense. We don't need this in our Constitution.
Okay, we've been speaking with Sue Jenick of the League of Women Voters. The state partisan primary and nonpartisan spring elections take place on Tuesday, April 2nd. To find out what's on your ballot and where to vote, go to myvote.wi.gov. Sue Jenick, thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you, Brian.
And we'll be back with the Outdoor Adventure Report, the Song of the Week, and some other stuff coming up right after this. It's 8:23, and it's time, as we do each and every week, with the Outdoor Adventure Report, the Equinox Edition, with Master Naturalist Paul Noldner. Take it away, Paul.
Hey, thank you, Brother Ryan and WRT for covering all things natural. As you mentioned, this week is the spring equinox, which officially means spring is here. In fact, the official equinox will be on Tuesday, March 19th. At 10 p.m. here, of course, the sun won't be up at that time, but it means the sun will be 45 degrees above the horizon because we're 45 degrees north of the equator, where it is 90 degrees above the horizon. You need to know these facts because we're living in an age of global warming. Our temperatures here really can vary a lot because on December 21, it's only 23 degrees above the horizon, which is almost 50% less light and energy. And on June 20, it's almost 70 degrees above the horizon, which is almost 50% more light and energy, warming that massive column of air above us that's like a stack of giant batteries full of moisture and heat. And they release energy and suck up moisture and drop energy the warmer they get. So there's your spring equinox addition for global warming. Anyway, let's get outside and enjoy some of this sun. Here is some fun and educational outdoor activities offered by your local nature groups. Your weekly Outdoor Adventure Report is brought to you by Madison Fund, Friends of Urban Nature, helping connect Madison area communities and kids with nearby nature year-round on free, fun, welcoming, diverse, fairly accessible, normally on fairly level trails, family and kid-friendly, naturalist-guided educational adventures every week year-round. Outings are free with no registration unless noted, and you don't need special equipment to enjoy nature. Just show up and join the fun. This past week, the Wisconsin Book Festival featured a talk by former Madisonian Trish O'Kane about her new book, Birding to Change the World, based on experiences right here in Madison. Jessica Ross spoke at the Arboretum on fungi of the Arboretum. Seniors learned about trees in spring on a senior adventure at Warner Park. Free family-friendly bird nature adventures featured a fungus among us walk with Sean Gear at Starkweather Creek and looking for signs of global warming with Seasons Creep with Alice Singer at Warner Park. Coming up this week, there's lots more to enjoy, learn, and do in nature. Your local Wild Ones chapter invites you to learn about indigenous wisdom, scientific knowledge, and the teaching of plants with an online talk by Robin Wall Kimmerer, the author of Braiding Sweetgrass, on Tuesday, March 19th. 5 p.m. It's an online talk. See wildones.org to register. Ecological restoration can be understood as an act of reciprocity in returning the gifts of the earth. This talk explores the ecological and ethical imperatives of healing damage we inflict on our land and waters. And this not only heals our land, but in healing the land, we are healing ourselves. Join the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, formerly Madison Audubon, on Thursday, March 21, 9 a.m. at Holy Wisdom Monastery on Century Avenue for an educational workshop to learn about saving our songbirds together, three ways to help at home. In North America, nearly 30% of birds have vanished in the past 50 years, and songbirds are among the hardest hit. The good news is we can help by taking some simple steps at home, like adding bird-friendly plants, reducing window collisions, and buying bird-friendly coffee, and I would add, in general, eating organic. It's much kinder to the earth. The public is invited to learn about pond monitoring at a free public talk at the Middleton Public Library on Thursday, March 21, 6 p.m. What's in our water? How can individuals like us help monitor our local ponds? It's fascinating, and it gets you outdoors, and it's important information shared with scientists. See midlibrary.org events for more info and free registration. UW students are invited to join the UW-Madison Student Audubon on birding field trip Saturday morning, March 23, and every Saturday morning. Email audubonsocietyuw@gmail.com for the details and updates. Join naturalist Eva Roos on a walk to look for the first flowers of spring on Saturday morning, March 23, 10 a.m., by the Aldo Leopold Nature Center, 330 Femwright Drive. Take a free, fun, family-friendly, and fairly accessible guided walk on level paths to look for the emergence of the first spring flowers on the ground and in the trees. Along the way, we'll stop to look and listen for birds, bugs, and other signs of spring that return with and depend on the flowers. On Saturday afternoon, March 23 at 1:30, join the naturalist dynamic duo of Lynn Pearson and Eva Roos for a spring equinox walk on easy hiking trails at Pheasant Branch Prairie Encampment, 4864 Pheasant Branch Road. Enjoy the coming of the spring equinox and the return of longer days, and learn about spring phenology. What do you see happening in nature around you as the sun creeps higher above the horizon and warms us? Enjoy a Sunday afternoon with a free educational naturalist guided arboretum nature walk on Sunday, March 24, 1 p.m. and every Sunday, meeting at the visitors center. You don't need to get up early to look for early bird migrants, birds that return to Wisconsin as soon as spring is in the air. Bird lovers of all ages and skill levels are invited to come to UW Lakeshore Preserve, University Bay Drive, on Sunday afternoon, March 24 at 1:30 p.m. Join enthused bird guides Chuck Henriksen and myself, Paul Milner, at the Picnic Point Kiosk for a free, family-friendly, accessible, fun birding adventure. The Bay's shorelines, woods, marsh, and prairies offer the equivalent of an interstate rest stop with food and shelter for a large number of species of birds, a great place to find early returning migrants like tundra swans and our familiar robins, bluebirds, and sandhill cranes. Lots more great adventures are coming up in April. You can find details about these and other nature outings and activities at cityofmadison.com parks, tinyurl.com/MadisonFunAdventures, and on Facebook and Nextdoor with your local groups, BIPOC Birding Club, Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, Feminist Bird Club, Get Kids Outside, Friends of Pheasant Branch, Friends of the Lakeshore Preserve, and other community and friends groups that help preserve and restore our urban parks and natural areas for other living things and create opportunities to enjoy nature close up right here in Madison. It's naturally fun.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flicks Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
And for the song of the week this week, we are going to hear The Grateful Dead with Uncle John's Band.
Well, the first days are the hardest days. Don't you worry anymore. 'Cause when life looks like easy street, your door. Think this through with me. Let me know your mind. What I want to know is, are you kind? It's a buck dancer's choice, my friends. Better take my advice. You know all the rules by now, and the fire from the ice. Will you come with me? Won't you come with me? Oh, oh, what I want to know. Will you come with me? Goddamn, will I declare? Have you seen the light? Their walls are built of cannonballs. Them is gone, check on me. Come
here, Uncle John's Band. It's 8:34. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. Not that long ago, absentee ballots made up a tiny proportion of total votes cast in any U.S. election. In recent years, due to changes in lifestyle and, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic, absentee voting has soared. Absentee voting peaked in the 2020 November election at the height of the pandemic, accounting for more than half of the 3.2 million votes cast in Wisconsin. Even in 2022, after the pandemic had ebbed, more than 750,000 Wisconsin voters chose to vote absentee. Absentee voting, it seems, is here to stay. This year, in-person absentee voting starts Tuesday, March 19th, 2 weeks ahead of the Wisconsin spring nonpartisan elections and partisan primary on April 2nd. Joining us now to tell us what to expect if voting absentee this year is Mary Beth Witzel-Bale, Madison City Clerk. Mary Beth, welcome back to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Good morning.
Good morning. So what's new about absentee balloting this year? It seems like every year something is a little bit different about how to vote in this state. Is there right. anything that people need to be aware of this year that is different than in previous years?
Yes, there's a new absentee envelope, and it's in use statewide, and it actually is more user-friendly than the old envelope. So we are hopeful that there will be fewer rejected absentee ballots because it's much more clear on the envelope itself which sections absolutely must be completed.
And what are those sections that have to be completed on this?
We need the voter signature, or if the voter can't sign, if they make their mark. So that's one section. And then there's a section for the voter's witness. So when you're marking your absentee ballot, you have somebody witnessing you who is attesting that nobody forced you to mark that ballot in a certain way. You started with a blank ballot and you marked it independently. So the witness has to sign a statement on the envelope. And now, new this year, the witness needs to also print their name, and then the witness lists their address.
And does the witness, so one of the things that I think has been confusing is that both the voter and the witness need to sign it, and what constitutes a signature?
Well, the signature doesn't need to be legible. So some people have signatures that are kind of works of art. And your signature is what your signature is, and we're not casting judgment on if you have a beautiful signature or we don't like your signature. You just sign it however you would normally sign something. And for some people, particularly in nursing homes and care facilities, maybe it's just making a mark because that's all they're able to do at this point, and that's okay.
And who can be a witness?
Anybody that you choose and trust to be your witness, but you can't be a candidate on the ballot.
Okay. And does your witness have to be a legal resident of Wisconsin?
No. In fact, we have some of our voters who are vacationing in other states and voting absentee, or they work for Epic and they're working abroad, or they're studying abroad. And if you're abroad, then you don't even need a U.S. citizen to be the witness, because sometimes you're the only U.S.
citizen. They're not available.
But if you're within the United States, you are going to find an adult U.S. citizen to be your witness. But they might not be a Wisconsin resident, and that's okay.
And so we've been talking about what happens when you actually get the ballot, but how do you get one? What do you need to do to get an absentee ballot? Is it too late this year if you want to vote absentee?
Realistically, if I were thinking I'd like to get my absentee in the mail, I would want to get my request in today, because it takes a week for our mail to go to Milwaukee, be sorted, come back to Madison, and be delivered. So that gives a week for it to reach you, but then you have to get it back to us to be counted on election day, so you need to have another week available for the post office to deliver it back to the clerk's office. And the election's 2 weeks from tomorrow. But you can request it quickly and easily if you go to myvote.wi.gov, and at that site, it will know whether you have an ID on file with the clerk's office. If you don't, it will ask you to upload a picture or a scan of your ID, and then you just indicate which elections you'd like to receive absentee ballots for. You're verifying that we do have you registered at the correct address, and if you need that ballot mailed to an address other than where you're registered to vote, you indicate that as well.
And do you need a reason or a rationale as to why you want to vote absentee?
Not in Wisconsin. So in Wisconsin, you could vote absentee just because that's what you prefer, and that's okay. Now, tomorrow we do start, as you mentioned, in-person absentee voting throughout the community. So if you don't want to risk the timeline with having mail delivered to and from you, that is a way to make sure that the clerk's office has your absentee back in time to be counted. So for the in-person absentee sites, often called early voting, you show up, you show your ID, and you vote your absentee ballot right there, and clerk's office personnel will serve as your witness.
Now, one of the things that's unusual about Wisconsin for in-person voting as opposed to absentee voting is that you can register to vote on election day. But in the absentee realm, let's say I'm not registered to vote and I know I'm not going to be in town on April 2nd, and I want to take care of all of this right now and, you know, go to one of the personnel. Can I do that?
Yes, you can. And the registration available at those sites is through the Friday before the election. State law stops it at that point. So the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday before Election Day, you can't register to vote. But you can still register at the polls on Election Day.
And so where can someone vote in Madison, vote absentee in person?
30-some locations. Something that would be close to most everyone would be if you wanted to vote at your nearest Madison Public Library. But we're also at many community centers and community gathering spaces. We're on the UW campus at the student unions. We're at the Madison College campus locations and at Edgewood College.
How do elections handle folks who may need some assistance with voting, either because of disabilities or if they speak a different language? Are there opportunities to get translations or assistance with voting?
Yes, there are. At each of our in-person absentee voting sites and at every polling place, we have something called an express vote. It's a machine that provides an opportunity to vote using a Braille keypad, or you could use it to mark your ballot using a touchscreen and high resolution. Some Spanish translation is also available on those machines. So it provides a lot of accessibility, but you're not really voting on the machine. It's a big fancy printer, so you're telling the machine how to mark your ballot, and then there's still a paper trail. It produces a ballot that will be fed into the machine and counted at the polls. But if somebody doesn't want to use that machine and wants to have another person assist them in marking the ballot, that is an option as well.
And how are absentee ballots counted? I mean, I've talked to some people who have expressed some concern, does that even get counted at all? Or does it get, delivered somewhere and forgotten in a bag someplace?
They are delivered to your polling place on Election Day. And you probably know people who are working at your polling place because they're from your own neighborhood. And they take those absentee envelopes, check them into the poll book. So they're basically standing there in your place, announcing your name and address at the poll book to get you checked in. And then the poll workers are processing 3 to 5 absentees at a time. So they're not keeping track of who voted which way. But they're feeding those ballots into the same machine you would use if you were at the polls on Election Day. And all of those ballots for your ward are counted together. So when the results are posted on election night, those results include the absentee voters for each ward. They're not counted separately or at a separate location.
And how do you keep track of them all between the time that you receive them and election day? How are they transported to the polls? And is there what kind of security is associated with those ballots?
Well, as we receive them every day, we're sorting them by ward and we're alphabetizing them to make it easier for at the polls. And then we have as many as we can fit into a large carrier envelope secured together with a tamper evident seal on the back. And we document that tamper evident serial number. And then those packages of absentee envelopes are secured in a bag that gets sealed with a tamper evidence seal bearing a unique serial number. And we document that on the chain of custody that the courier will bring to the polling place. The poll workers are verifying those seal numbers and then processing those absentees at the polls.
All right. We've been speaking with Madison City Clerk Mary Beth Witzel-Bale. Absentee balloting begins Tuesday, March 19th. To find out more about City of Madison absentee ballots, you can go to cityofmadison.com/clerk. To find out more where to vote in person or what's on your ballot, go to myvote.wy.gov. Mary Beth Witzel-Bale, thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you.
We'll be back with Framing Cultures, Jose Carlos Teixeira speaking with artist and archivist Matt Backham right after this. It's 8:47. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. Framing Culture is an arts and culture segment airing bi-weekly on the Wednesday edition of the WORT Local News. This week, host Jose Carlos Teixeira spoke with artist, collective investigator, and archivist Matt Backham.
Issues around health, but I'm glad to be back. And today, I have a pleasure to be interviewing an artist and a friend. His name is
Matthew Backham.
Hello, Matthew. And I'm connecting directly from Madison, Wisconsin to Minneapolis, Minnesota. How are you doing?
Just fine. Thanks, Jose. Just got back from work and very pleased to speak with you.
It's a great opportunity to catch up with you and also to introduce Matthew for those who don't know about him. So Matthew is a visual and conceptual artist, researcher, and educator who has spent some substantial time in Madison while teaching at UW-Madison. And I always remember undergrads and grads praising his inspirational classes and lectures. And so my first question would be, what are your fondest memories of working with students here?
Well, Jose, that's a very tough question. There were so many moments with so many students. And, you know, as an educator, they don't get ranked into a place. They become part of your practice. You know, it's hard to point one out. It was a real pleasure to work with so many lovely people in Madison. And I'm just glad to hear people, that there's still some whisper that I was there, because it was a great time for me.
So Matthew, after 2017, he actually spent a period of time in his beloved New York City. And then he went back to Minneapolis, where he is now. So Matthew, I'm actually quite interested in having you letting us know about a project of yours called Collective Investigation. And it's a process that you have applied and perfected over the years and in different contexts. And right now at the public library there, is that correct?
That's right, Jose. I've been working on the collective investigation, the method of collective investigation since 1998, its point of inception. And it's a very simple, small group method for coming together and exploring collections of printed matter together. And through a simple series of steps, creating a script that we all kind of perform together that then also goes on as a two-dimensional object, a book of its own. The method itself is very simple. It takes about 2.5 hours. All you need is 5 to 10, 12 people and a collection of printed matter. So most lately, I've been working with the Minneapolis Public Library of the Hennepin County Library System to present a series at the library over the course of the last 7 or 8 months, but it's a year-long project, ideally, where I've been organizing these kinds of investigations in conference rooms on each distinct floor of the library, the third floor being arts and music and literature, fourth floor being social sciences and history, and now we're moving on to the second floor coming up in March and into April, which is science and technology. Going on, it's something that I shared in Madison within the context of my teaching, but I've been doing kind of throughout the United States and sometimes in Europe over the course of the last 25 years.
Yes, and that's why I was particularly interested in having you shed some light on that, because it's definitely one of the projects that you have been always engaged with. And I think that as time progresses, you also are probably finding new ways and new frames within this process. So right now, it's actually fascinating to hear you are exploring the different levels. And by the way, for those who don't know, the Minneapolis Public Library is a beautiful, great building by Pelly Architects. And I was there last year while visiting Matthew, and I had the pleasure to just immerse myself, as I love doing it, in libraries. And it's definitely a special, wonderful space. So let me ask you, is the space in itself also somehow conducive or nourishing the process itself of the collective investigation?
Well, I mean, it's my feeling that any library, regardless of size, is nourishing in some essential way. In this one, it's a fairly monumental library by civic standards in the United States. And, you know, it was ideally somehow designed for this kind of thing. Certainly, in terms of the creation of spaces in which people can gather in combination with remarkable collections of printed material, including picture collections and all kinds of fantastic objects that the library maintains on a regular basis. So I think this particular location for me is special, as it's also the first library in which I was kind of operating as a teenager, learning about the city, learning about libraries, learning about a lot of things. In this particular case, it's not the same building. The building that I grew up with was demolished and then replaced by the building that currently exists, a process that at the time I was not thrilled about, but now I see it's what we have, and it's very much of the moment. I mean, the library space of, especially civic library spaces of 2024, strangely contested spaces, in that they offer their staff and their collections and their structure offer so much to people, but some of the dynamics, both inside of shared public space as a general concern, specifically, to be honest, for our unhoused populations, who find the library be a place that they're welcome and they can participate in on whatever level is their choosing. It's a very free and open space. Of course, this creates a certain kind of tension with people who don't have perhaps a certain level of sympathy with unhoused people or experience with unhoused people.
Exactly. And I can only imagine that, as you say, that creates a specific dynamics, on one hand, all embracing, on the other, challenging for the use of these commons of the public space.
And the reality, a very important reality, is that something like collective investigation can bring participants to the space, and they can experience it, and they can see that indeed it's a very functional space. And there may be, you may be discovering things that are new to you, but they are not threatening. They are not something that should discourage you from participating in this very particular commons of the library space. On the other hand, there's a challenge within the notion of the library itself, which has been certainly accelerated by the transition to digital sharing. There was a time in which, only not so long ago, that the way things were shared, where they were created through analog methods and analog distribution methods. That's what mostly is in the library. But the library is also a great digital resource. The libraries in general have been participating in the creation of this kind of digital world. They are very important parts of it now. But how do you get people to this? That doesn't bring people to the structure.
Precisely.
And to the commons, and to the shared space and timing and the physical aspect of knowledge, you know. Browsing is a very kind of romantic thing. You're moving your body through time and space in search of something. And it's an object that must be, you can't comprehend by a click. You have to comprehend by a grasp.
And that's why I find the process intriguing and fascinating, because it sort of rescues that bodily awareness that so many, probably from younger generations, have never felt, because they are just engaged with the digital dimension from their laptops. I just would like now, in the last couple of minutes, Matthew, to, let's say, swim and dive from the library as this deep and wonderful space of the archive into your own practice, in which for so many years you have dealt with archives. So tell us a little bit, what have you been doing in terms of your art experimentations and new projects, in which I know that you are still examining archives and photos and prints and sculpture making?
I find myself at this point in my career, you know, having kind of begun serious engagement in the early 1990s as both a presenter but also a maker of things. And I find myself now having a kind of a dual course, one running in a studio model, which is a place where I negotiate in private with the material that I've accumulated, whether it's my own personal photographic archives or material that I've inherited from various sources, which are other photographic archives. On my studio side, I try to work with this kind of world. I've had a lot of experience working with the quote-unquote archives of the outside, So the archive of the self is happening in the studio. Working with the public space and trying to find an even more dynamic and ultimately, ideally positive way to contribute my practice is the other channel. It's a two channels. I have in this space of the public interaction, it's important to me to balance these things. They're like two wheels on a bike. Mm-hmm. One drives the other in a way that I don't really understand, but they're both on the same bike, which is my practice. So artistically, this becomes the way to understand how you operate, mm-hmm. how I operate. And in my case, it happens to be these two interlinked systems, but they're all grounded in a larger self project, of course. But these are the artistic specifications of the bike, so to speak.
Last time I visited you, I remember looking at these beautiful new prints that you have with some archival images, and I thought, wow, what an amazing new body of work. Thank you so much for your participation in Framing Culture, and I send you a hug to Minneapolis.
Hugs, hugs, hugs back to you and back to Madison. I do miss it, and I'm so pleased that this interview is going to be broadcast from WORT. I was a big, big fan when I was there. I really wish the best to the station and all the volunteers.
Thank you, Matthew.
Ciao.
And it's 8:58, and that wraps up our program for today. I'd like to thank our guests, Sue Jenick, Program Director of the Dane County League of Women Voters, Madison City Clerk Mary Beth Witzel Bale, and thanks to Framing Culture and Jose Carlos Teixeira for the interview with artist and archivist Matthew Backham. Side note, I remember Matthew Backham's documentary, What America Needs, back in 1997, premiered with our own documentary, Subdue the Universe, back in Minneapolis. So nice to hear that name again. Thanks to our producer, Nicholas Wooten, who pulled double duty today as our engineer, piloting the mighty WORT soundboard and spinning all the great tunes today with an assist from our engineer, Nate Carlin. Thank you both. Thanks to our receptionist, Lori Ranney. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We are also live streaming and podcasting at WORTFM.org. My name is Brian Standing. Global Revolution is coming up next, right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 18th.
MetMen here for Action Weirdos Productions. This week in music history for March 18th. On March 17th, No Doubt released their self-titled debut album. I'm going to leave you dangling until the end to reveal the year. No Doubt formed on the coattails of second wave ska and shared the scene here in the USA with bands like Sublime, the Mighty Mighty Bosstones, and Less Than Jake. Early gigs often included covers of two-tone classics like Too Much Pressure by The Specials. The album was recorded for less than $13,000, and to promote it, No Doubt toured with Rage Against the Machine and Public Enemy. The track Trapped in a Box is about the power that the media has over our lives and how it can control one's mind. Although many tracks are built on a ska bass, the band brings the funk pretty heavily on several tracks. Paulina has the musical style of classic first wave ska. Have you guessed the year? It's 1992. no doubt went on to greater popularity with their third album, Tragic Kingdom, but their debut has a lot to offer, especially for ska fans. I'm always amazed that ska has not gained more traction as a popular genre of music. Perhaps it's because too many people are trapped in a box. Also this week, March 18th, 1965, a tractor trailer carrying 15 tons of bananas loses control and crashes on its way down a hill. Singer-songwriter Harry Chapin tells the story of the tragic event in his song, 30,000 Pounds of Bananas. That was this week, years ago. Act as young as you feel. You're getting older, but you're also getting more entitled to being yourself.
Of mashed bananas.
Learn more about defending Wisconsin's sacred waters from dangerous mine proposals in a virtual presentation tonight with Dr. Al Geddix. Geddix is a well-known advocate for